Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where the Road Go. Tonight I'm going to be talking with Robert Schneck, who is a collector of weird historical stories. Some really unusual stuff that we're going to be talking about tonight. He's also the guy who recorded the events that then became the movie The Bye Bye Man. We'll get into that a little bit. And he's going to tell the full story of that. We didn't have time in the show, but he's going to tell the full story of The Bye Bye Man for patrons. So if you want to become a patron, go to the page, wheredidtheroadgo.com, and it's only $3 a month. I may eventually add another level to that. I'm coming up with different ideas. And we have a bunch of T-shirt designs, and patrons are seeing them first. And eventually, it's not just going to be T-shirts. We're going to use one of the on-demand sites, so you'll be able to put it on mugs, hats, whatever you want, if you like the design. So that is upcoming. I guess that's about it for right now. So let's get into this talk with Robert Schneck. So I'm talking with Robert Schneck, and welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you, Soraya. I'm glad to be here.
And I've heard you a number of times on Project Archivist, and I was always fascinated by the stories you've collected over the years. And you have a number of books out, right?
Yeah, I have two adult books, The Bye Bye Man and Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist. I have a young adult book called Are You Psychic? And I'm working on a new one.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the new one going to be?
The new one will be, like the other two, a collection of strange but true stories. I think this one is going to be have a little more emphasis on madness and murder, though.
Okay. Yeah. And how do you tell whether or not they're true stories? Like, what kind of research do you put behind it?
Well, first of all, a lot of them turn out not to be true, or to be wildly exaggerated, or to be what is essentially an old urban legend, or so a lot of this is like panning for gold. You know, you've got to pan through a lot of dirt to find that occasional nugget. So I spend a lot of time doing research. In fact, one of the great things about having a Facebook page, I have a Facebook page called Historian of the Strange. And one of the great things about making myself find a story to post every single day is that I keep turning up things. I have to keep turning up things. I don't have a choice. That's my obligation. Every once in a while, I come across something and I say, wow, I really like that. And I can always tell when I'm going to end up writing about something because I'll post it and I'll forget about it. And but the story will stay on some part of my mind and start nibbling at me. And it says something along the lines of, you know, that has potential. Maybe it's not going to have a great beginning, middle, or an end, but there's something there that's weird enough to pursue. And so I will normally start by doing what everyone else does. I'll just do a quick Google search. But then I'll start to hit the newspaper databases, which are, a lot of them are online. Some of them are free. Some of them you subscribe. I subscribe because you just get it's it gives you these it allows you to search them much more easily. So I will start to collect newspaper clippings, and then after I've collected them, I put them into loose leaves. I've got a bookcase containing nothing but clippings in loose leaf binders, and from there, I will start to write out the basics. When I've when I've read every clipping that I can find on the subject, I'll start to write out the basics of the story, years, dates, names, things like that. And then I'll begin to approach the local historical societies, the local libraries, whatever I can, even the Chamber of Commerce in some of these small towns, because some towns are so small, the Chamber of Commerce will also be connected to the library and the Historical Society, and that's the easiest way for me to find out if there's anything to it. On occasion, I will start looking for a story that the local people find embarrassing, and they are not very cooperative. But most of the time, when you get, for example, the local historian who running the Historical Society, they will be thrilled, especially if you approach them with a story they don't know, which has happened a number of times. Then they get excited, and they start to research with you, which is, once you've got that going, you know you're going to get great material. But most of the time, these stories fall through. They either simply they turn out to not be true, happens a lot, or they turn out to be a complete distortion of what actually happened. In fact, the original title of my book, The Bye-Bye Man, the original title was The President's Vampire. And I called it that because I found a story in one of Charles Swart's books. I don't remember which one it was. Maybe The Book of the Damned, where he describes a vampire that was active on a fishing ship out of Boston. And the story went something like this, that there was this fishing ship, and one of the sailors went missing. And that was strange. They looked for him. They couldn't find him. But then another sailor went missing. And when that happened, the captain of the fishing boat ordered a complete search of the ship. So top to bottom, they searched the ship. And in the hold, they found one sailor drinking the blood of a dying sailor. And they put him in irons, brought him back to Boston, where he was sentenced to death. That was the story I found in Charles Fort. And eventually I found the newspaper clippings that I'm sure he was using. Well, when I began to look into the story a little more, it turned out to be a complete distortion. The story was nothing like the story that happened, of what really happened. In fact, I did so much research that I eventually found the ship's log and the page written presumably by the captain of what really happened that day on board the ship. And what happened was very simple. The ship's cook got into an argument with one of the sailors, stabbed him, threw the knife overboard. He was put in chains. They were not a fishing boat, and they were not right out of Boston. They were actually a whaling ship, and they were in the Indian Ocean. So they transferred this cook to another ship, and he was brought back to Boston, where he was put on trial and sentenced to death. However, there was evidence. There were reasons to think that he was not quite competent. So the president of the United States, who was then Andrew Johnson, Abraham Lincoln's successor, commuted his sentence to life in prison. The man's name was actually James Brown, and he spent several years in prison, but was eventually transferred from there to the lunatic asylum called St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C., and there he eventually died. Now, there were more accurate stories, but those were not the ones that made it into Fort's book and into a lot of other books that took the information from Fort. You'll find a lot of collections of like vampire encyclopedias, historical vampires that quote Fort, but didn't go further and find out that the story was actually a complete fabrication. Now, how the fabrication occurred, that's another question. And I have a theory about that. And I have a theory that Fort Story might have eventually had some even greater influence. But that's, you know, again, that's something else.
Well, but that's interesting. How do you think these fabrications did come about?
Well, I can't prove this, of course, but the only thing I can think of is that the year that the story, Brown was convicted and sentenced and spent several years in prison, but when he was transferred, the same year that he was transferred was the year that the Mercy Brown story came out from Rhode Island. Now, I'm sure most of your listeners know Mercy Brown. She is the most famous vampire who lived and died in the state of Rhode Island. And her story was very simply that the Brown family suffered from a number of deaths. First, I think Mercy's older sister or possibly her mother died. Then Mercy died. Then another child died, and when the brother began to show signs that he was dying, Mercy's body was dug up, and all the bodies of her, of his siblings and possibly his mother, I think his mother, were dug up and checked to see if they had decomposed. Well, Mercy's body apparently had not decomposed, which in retrospect is not a surprise. She died in the middle of winter and was buried in the middle of winter, so she probably didn't have much of a chance to decompose. But after they dug her up, they decided that she must be the one who was feeding on the brother. So what they did was they opened up the body. They removed, I think, the liver and the heart, but don't quote me on that. And they burned them. They then gave the ashes to the brother to drink. I suppose the idea was that those organs, which did not appear to be decomposed, had somehow acquired the vitality that had been taken from the brother. And so by having him drink the ashes, he might reacquire that vitality. And now this might seem to have nothing to do with it, but these stories were told at the exact same time that James Brown. So you've got James Brown, you've got Mercy Brown, you've got them appearing in the, I think it was the same month. So the only thing I can think of is that either some board editor or some board reporter decided to jazz up the story and added the vampire element, or there was some honest cross-wiring and somehow the story of this sailor, this deranged sailor, became a story of a vampire. Now, again, I can't prove this. It's just the only thing I can think of that might explain it. But one other thing that I think is really interesting about this, and this is the sort of thing where I don't feel competent to do the work myself. I think for this you'd need a real literary historian, someone who understands the work of Bram Stoker backwards and forwards, where he did his research and all that. But I do know that Bram Stoker was collecting newspaper clippings about vampirism, and he did have a number of American clippings, and I think it's possible that the story of a sailor who was drinking the blood of other sailors and they were disappearing one by one might have inspired the chapter in Bram Stoker's book Dracula, where Dracula is traveling from Transylvania to England aboard a ship. I think it was called the Demeter. And he's feeding off the sailors one by one who disappear. So again, I can't prove it, but there is a resemblance between those two stories. And Bram Stoker was collecting material for Dracula at the time. So it's possible.
Hmm. That's really interesting that it would have that kind of an impact. I mean, that
was certainly not something I expected to come up as I was doing the research, but I was also not expecting it to be a knife fight that went bad. You know, it was just, again, you never know where these things are going to go. Now, the story of James Brown was, that one really interested me for a specific reason, and that was that the story was so widely told and retold. So I was going to stick with that one no matter how the results turned out. Because when I started out, my idea was, oh boy, I found an interesting example of an early American serial killer. And I'm going to write about that. Won't this be interesting? I was not expecting the whole thing to turn out to be fake or a mistake or whatever it was that made this story. So, but I wasn't disappointed in that case. It was just, to my mind, I was just so surprised at the way it turned out. But when you've done, but a lot of these stories will turn out to be, it'll turn out that the foundation for them is so vague, so, it's just, it's not even fun to write about. Because, for example, you'll do 5 minutes research, you'll say, oh, this person never existed. So, you know, then something else is going on. And usually it'll turn out to be either a newspaper hoax or something else that has happened a lot, where in the early Strange But True books, when you've got people like Frank Edwards and a couple of other writers that produced the early Strange But True books that were so popular and had an enormous influence on me, like books like Stranger Than Science. Stranger Than Science was the book that launched me. My mother left it on her night table when I was about 9, and I practically ate the book. I mean, I devoured it. I was fascinated by it. I still am. But in retrospect, you know, I know that what Frank Edwards did was he really just took back issues of Fate magazine, took some of the good stories, compressed them into about 2 pages, 3 pages tops. I think that's the longest story in Stranger Than Science, and republished it. And there's nothing wrong with that. But as a result, you've got a lot of people who are using Frank Edwards as their source, and they don't realize that the Fate stories might not have been that accurate. And as a matter of fact, it's almost certain that a lot of these stories that have appeared in Strange But True books are based on works of literature. You know, the most famous example, of course, is that story that has been told and retold so many times about a farmer crossing a field and suddenly vanishing. And it's the story. I think the name Lurch is usually applied. L-E-R-C-H is, I think, the name that's usually applied to that farmer. And the story, I'm sure it's in Stranger Than Science, and it's in a lot of other books. But the story was a work of fiction written by Ambrose Bierce and published as a work of fiction, but somehow made the jump from fiction to fact and has been repeated so many times that you can say, well, look, these 20 books say the story really happened, but those 20 books are all repeating each other. You know, it's so the real trick is, you know, researching the paranormal, researching the strange but true has got to be done with at least the same seriousness, at least that's the way I do it, with the same seriousness that an historian who's writing about the Battle of Gettysburg is going to apply to it. You've got to find primary sources. You've got to keep digging until you find out, where did this story come from? Is there any earlier reference to it? That sort of thing. And, you know, when I began to do this, what I really wanted to do was I wanted to write about this as seriously as the most serious historian will write about their work. And that's what I set out to do. And I have really been surprised at how many readers appreciate that, because I truly dislike writers that, when they write about the paranormal, feel like they're slumming and don't feel that they have the obligation to put the work into these stories that a real historian, that's with quotation marks around it, will put into their work. I take this stuff very seriously, and I love it too much to do a slapdash job. You know, this comes from wanting, when somebody reads one of my stories, I want them to be able to look at that footnote and say, oh, this is where it came from. I might be wrong. You know, you can always make errors. And when you're trying to muster 1,000 facts, yes, you're going to make errors. And, sure. But I want them to know where I got it from, so they can look if they want to. You know, maybe they can dig further. Because again, I think people who don't do that are doing a serious disservice to their readers, because they're not treating them with the respect they deserve.
I think that paranormal writers sometimes feel like they're not going to get any attention unless the story is really, really big, like really, really out there type of, you know, over the top type of thing. So they don't really worry about the facts so much as the
the effect.
Well, not the effect, the style,
the drama, the
they
want to tell a compelling story.
Sure, but I think the true stories are far more compelling than the ones that are blown up out of proportion.
Yes, I agree. They're always more interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, very often, okay, maybe it turned out that the paranormal element that originally got your attention was exaggerated, or it was even non-existent, but inevitably you're going to come up with a story about human beings and what they think and what they do. That's fascinating. I have never read a poltergeist case that was as interesting as the family that produced the poltergeist case. It's true. These are often very dysfunctional families that have all kinds of bizarre dynamics going on in them. And it really is fascinating. The fact that it sometimes seems to produce paranormal phenomena, it just adds to that interest. But these are always, they're interesting on a human level. And I think you should, I think a writer should always consider that you are telling fascinating stories about people as well as phenomena.
Yeah, definitely. What made you want to start writing these books?
Well, originally, I began as an illustrator. And I did a lot of illustration, but I realized that I wasn't getting any satisfaction from it. I envied the writers because I thought what they were doing was so much more interesting than just drawing a picture of what they wrote. And I also disliked, the actual business of illustration I didn't care much for, but what got me started, I can actually tell you exactly what it was I was reading I just happened to be reading two books at the same time. One was called Where Bigfoot Walks, which was put out, in the 1990s, I think, by a writer who was not what you would call, he is not a cryptozoologist. He makes no claims to, you know, to having seen Bigfoot or anything like that. But it ended up being a book about Bigfoot hunters, which was fascinating. Kind of like the way the newspaper Saucer Smear ended up being a newspaper about ufologists more than a newspaper about UFOs. But I read Bigfoot, Where Bigfoot Walks, and at the same time I was reading a book called I think it was called Writings by Serial Killers or something along those lines, and it was a collection of memoirs, poetry, stories, all written by serial killers or presumed serial killers. It was a fairly gruesome book, but also very interesting. And one of the memoirs was written by Charles Starkweather. Now, Charles Starkweather, for your listeners who don't remember him, was the quintessential juvenile delinquent of the 1950s. He fashioned himself after James Dean, and he was angry at the world. And one day, he and his girlfriend set out and just started shooting people. They murdered her family, and then they set out on this road trip and just began killing people at random and stealing their cars and killing more people until finally they were apprehended. Now, when Starkweather was, I don't know if this was on when he was on death row or whether he was just, this was just during his trial, someone gave him a notebook and asked him to write his autobiography, which he did. And he grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and he described an episode from his youth that really caught my eye. He talked about how when he was young, he would lie in his bedroom in the morning, and sometimes the figure of death would appear outside his bedroom. He could see it through the window. And the figure of death would scream, would make these horrible shrieks. Now, he included a drawing, and I'm sorry, the drawing looked like the silhouette of a Bigfoot. And So here he talks about, now, I don't think Lincoln, Nebraska is what you call Bigfoot country. But here he's talking about this mysterious figure, massive, with a pointed head, screaming. And, you know, all my spider senses were tingling because I was thinking to myself, that sounds just like a Bigfoot.
Right.
This was years before the word Bigfoot even existed. So I wrote the story up. I decided, look, I've never written a story in my life. I'm going to try. I'm going to send it to Fate Magazine. We'll see what happens. And I even included an illustration because I didn't think the story by itself would be enough. I did not have any confidence in my work at the time. So I included an illustration and was absolutely shocked when they accepted it. And as a result, that led to me wanting to – oh, and then Lauren Coleman wrote to me. He sent me an email asking if he could use it in one of his books, the story that I wrote. Well, that did it for me. I mean, getting emails from Lauren Coleman and having stuff appear in Fate, that was it, because I said to myself, okay, I'm spending the rest of my life writing about weird stuff because I love it more than anything else in the world. And I decided to go with the strange but true rather than calling myself a writer about the paranormal because, frankly, I don't have – you run out of things to say about the paranormal. At least I do. Maybe someday I'll have more to say about it. But the the majority of – most of the time you end up saying, well, we really had no idea what happened. There was no big climax. The thing just sort of petered out. And here we are. We have learned nothing. We have accumulated no more knowledge now than we had when we started. But boy, wasn't that weird. And it seems to have been true. you write that enough and you begin to get a little frustrated. So again, I began to focus more on the human aspect of it, the historical aspect of it, and what it revealed about American history and American culture of the time. I limited my work to America for a couple of reasons. First, it's almost all going to be in English, so that's a big plus.
Right.
And it's much easier to do research inside your own country. One of the first stories I wrote was actually for the Canadian Historical Society, and simply doing research in Canada, you've got to fill out these forms. It's real annoying. And also, I am fascinated by the United States. My family's been in the country for 100 years. So as far as I'm concerned, we pretty much just got here. And so I am still fascinated by the United States. And I love the way that the strange and the paranormal exposes aspects of its history in a way that normal history never will. I'll give you an example. Let's say, this is from Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist. One of the stories that I found was a story about a small cult in Kansas City. Don't ask me, I think it was Kansas City, Missouri. I'm pretty sure it was Kansas City, Missouri. And according to the story, according to the newspaper clippings that I found, this cult was led by a minister, well, a preacher, let's say, because I don't think he was an ordained minister, but he was a man who felt called to preach. And he concentrated on the idea that blood is life, and that healing, that the members of his group could heal each other by drinking the blood of healthy people. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. And I began to look into it, and I was never able to verify the story. I found the police chief mentioned in the story was definitely real. The several people mentioned in the story, definitely real. But I was never able to confirm the principles of the story. I was never able to find anything about them. However, this led to something else that I never knew, and that was the fact that during the 19th century, a lot of people, and I mean people in Europe and all over the United States, maybe not in great numbers, but certainly this was a widespread practice, a lot of people used to go to slaughterhouses and drink the blood of freshly slaughtered animals to gain their strength. It was actually prescribed by some doctors. Now, we're not going back to the 18th century here. We're talking about well into the 19th century. And it was I found clippings describing this practice in every major city in the United States. Chicago, which had vast slaughterhouses. New York City, Baltimore, every city, at least. Maybe not on the far West Coast, but that might be just because I never found any clippings from there. But this was widely done. Now, I ask you, have you ever come across an American history book that talked about the way people used to go to slaughterhouses to drink cow's blood in the morning?
No, I haven't.
And again, we're not talking about something that was done by a small group of deviants. We're talking about something that was prescribed by some doctors. This was actually considered a reasonable therapy. In fact, sometimes they would get very specific. For example, there was a New York slaughterhouse where this woman who had been feeling very weak and run down, she would go there every 3 days and drink, and I remember this is what they said, 2 big bumpers of blood, hot blood. She felt it restored her health. Now, another thing about this that fascinated me was I had no idea the human body could drink hot blood. I had always been under the impression that if you did that, it would vomit back up. Apparently not. At least cow's blood seems to be reasonably digestible. In fact, one of the reporters, while he was there, he said he was going to try it. So he was given a glass of it, and he said it was actually good. He said it tasted like hot milk, but it had a meatier flavor to it. And he found it easy to drink, and it stayed down. So he said, you know, for him, it was it seemed like a less unreasonable thing than it might sound to us. Now, I was fascinated by this. In fact, as it turned out, I began to do research into the history of drinking blood as medicine, and it goes back at least to the ancient Egyptians and Romans. In fact, people that suffered from epilepsy used to go down into the arena in ancient Rome, and as a gladiator was dying, they would apply their mouth to the bleeding wound and drink the blood hot out of the body. That way they could acquire the strength of the dying gladiator. Now,
okay,
you would think that something like that, well, that's the ancient world. However, drinking the blood of executed criminals for the treatment of epilepsy was still being done in the 19th century. In fact, Hans Christian Andersen, when he was a child, saw it being done. A man was beheaded in a town square, and he saw a glass of blood collected and given to a child who was suffering from epilepsy. Now, again, you look at that and you say, well, again, 19th century, it was a long time ago. It's gone, you know, that's gone. That's what right. That's what I thought. Then I did a book panel at a place called Books New Jersey, which is an annual book fair for local writers and readers. And when I was done telling this story about the blood cult that didn't exist, but this 19th century practice of drinking blood, one of the people who was on the panel with me, she met me afterwards, and she said that her father worked in a slaughterhouse, presumably in the 60s and the 70s, and he said that people were still coming in to get fresh blood to drink to treat certain illnesses. So we are not Wow. We are not talking about something that happened 100 years ago. We're talking about something that happened that happened 50 years ago at the most, and for all I know, might still be going on in a quiet way. So yeah. Again, this never would have happened. I never would have learned all this if I hadn't looked up this story that turned out to be, at least if not untrue, unverifiable. So this is the kind of thing you learn when you begin to dig into the strange but true American history.
Wow. If we go back to the Bigfoot thing for a minute, with the guy seeing the shape of Bigfoot outside sure. his window, if we look at that as not a flesh and blood Bigfoot, if we take that, at least some Bigfoot encounters have some kind of paranormal source to them mm-hmm. rather than an unknown cryptid, you got to wonder if that's something that somehow set him on his path that he was meant to see, that had that deep effect on him.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why Lauren Coleman was interested in the story, because there are some people who are interested in Bigfoot who have what I consider a very romantic attitude towards the idea. They see them as loving, natural, you know, they become symbols of nature and love and kind of a new agey interpretation of them. I know one popular writer on the subject of paranormal Bigfoot has come up with, it's almost like a religious description of them doing healing and being very wise spiritual beings that are able to move through dimensions and all those yep. things, and even connects them to aliens. And well, Lauren has Lauren's attitude is a little more was a little less optimistic. He has also recorded a bunch of cases that suggest something a little less benign. And mm-hmm. you know, he looks at, for example, these cases where Bigfoot where even if it's a spiritual phenomenon, it seems to be a bad one. And you know, this is also not the only example of a connection between Bigfoot and a serial killer. I believe it was in Yellowstone. I think it was in Yellowstone National Park. There was a serial killer named Cary Stainer. He was very famous because his brother had been kidnapped as a child and kept by this man for several years, and then he escaped. Do you remember that story?
Yes, yes, I do.
Yeah, his brother died in an accident when he was an adolescent. Well, Cary Stainer grew up, lived in Yellowstone, and he ended up murdering a woman and two children and two young women she was traveling with, and he ended up beheading a ranger that worked there, if I remember correctly. I think she was a ranger, but I'm not positive about that. And he also claims to have had encounters with Bigfoot. So you know, there are these other less attractive stories connected to Bigfoot. And also when you look at Native American stories that are supposedly based on Bigfoot, these are stories about cannibals and goblins and monsters that drink blood. I mean, anyone who's looked into stories about, you know, the I think it's pronounced Sonoqua, which is the, which some people say is the Kwakiutl, which is one of the tribes, I think, up in British Columbia. The Kwakiutl, I think that's their version of this giant hairy monster that some people think might be a mythical version of Bigfoot. It is not anything pleasant. It kidnaps children, it eats them, and when the Tsunakwa is finally defeated and burned to ashes, the ashes come to life and become mosquitoes so they can continue to drink blood.
What is it with blood? Why is that such a common factor, you think?
Well, I mean, I can't say for certain, but blood, you know, it's actually very interesting. Our attitude towards blood is, I think most people, the ones who don't faint when they see it, is, you know, this is the way the body carries nutrients and oxygen throughout the body. That's what blood does. If I'm remembering correctly, I could be wrong. I know it carries oxygen for sure.
Yes.
So I mean, that's what blood is for. That's what blood does. However, traditionally, and for the last 5-10,000 years, people have seen blood as not some body fluid, but as life itself. The idea that if you were holding a cup of blood, you were not holding a body fluid, you were holding actual life. This was the essence of life. And consequently, it was transferable. That's the basis of vampirism. The idea that life, at least in blood, is transferable. In fact, you know, it's interesting. When I was doing that research on the blood drinking, I began to look at some websites devoted to people who are living vampires. That is, people who make drinking blood a regular part of their life.
Right.
And now there are sexual aspects to it. For some people, it's a form of sadomasochistic ritual. I mean, that's one thing. But then you also get another group, maybe fewer, I don't know, who actually feel that drinking blood is good for them. It makes them feel good. It makes them feel attractive. It makes them look good. It makes them feel younger and more energetic. And every few years, maybe every 5 years or so, some scientist is going to announce that transferring the blood of young mice to old mice has a rejuvenating effect. And that you will find stories about that, again, going back thousands of years. It's, again, I don't mean to keep going off the subject, but...
No, it's okay.
Well, one of the things that I find so interesting about this idea about this transferability of blood and the whole idea of Dracula as a nobleman who extends his life by drinking the blood of common people, which, you know, that can be a symbol on a lot of levels, politically, culturally, a lot of things. But when you look at traditional medieval beliefs, very often you'll find these periods where when the king is old and dying, this belief will start to circulate that children are being abducted and their blood drained as medicine to keep the king or some nobleman alive. And then you've got stories about people like Elizabeth Bathory, who supposedly really did that, or at least the story was filtered through the folk belief, and that's, you know, and then became that. From what I understand, she was really just a sadist, and who enjoyed torturing her servants for some bizarre reason, and the blood the blood aspect of it, that she would use blood to maintain her youth, probably came from this tradition of folklore where the nobility would feed on the common people to maintain their health and youth. So I suspect that that's actually the way the story worked. And of course, you've also got stories like Gilles de Rais and others who also preyed on the children of common people, but that's something else.
All right. All right. What's one of the stories that, you know, you looked at and you said, there's no way that this is going to be true. And then it turned out that it was true.
You know, I think probably the one that surprised me a lot was the story of a man named James Moon, who there's a chapter in Mrs. Wakeman dedicated to people that commit suicide by cutting their own heads off. Now, I don't remember how it got started, but there was some question in my mind about whether people were actually able, if they had a knife or something, could they actually cut their own head off? Is that possible? Right. And that question led to looking at people, almost always men, but not always. So there are exceptions. But looking at men that committed suicide by building machines to cut their own heads off. Now, I came across the story of James Moon, who was an inventor who lived in, I can't remember whether it was Indiana or Illinois, but I think it was Indiana. And he supposedly built this big device and chopped his own head off. Well, okay, I began to do the research, and it turned out that the story was even stranger than what I had read. He built this device, which was essentially an axe on a hinge. It was really a fairly simple device. Only he built it at home and on a farm. He then checked into the hotel in downtown, the nicest hotel in the town, and he constructed the machine inside the hotel. In fact, he spent the last day of his life going around buying big pieces of sheet metal and buying a great big broadaxe head that he needed for the machine. He checked into the hotel with his heavy trunk, and it contained pre-cut pieces of wood and everything he needed to construct the machine. So what he ended up doing was this. He screwed a wooden box to the floor, and in this box he put cotton batting. He sprinkled chloroform on this cotton batting and then lay down with it, with his head in the box, after strapping his body to the floor. Now, the machine that he built was like this. Imagine a 12-foot axe blade with this gigantic, with this oversized sharpened axe at the top. Now, this, I think it was 12 or 7 feet long. I think it was at least 7 feet long. And it was made from a number of pieces of wood that he had to screw together, that he had measured already. Now, he attached this to the floor by some kind of a hinge and lifted the axe handle up with a cord that was then tied to an iron bracket on the window. He then put a candle next to the bracket, lit it. It was on the bracket next to the cord, rather.
Right,
so
right.
As the candle burned down, it would eventually burn through the cord. So the idea was that he would be lying on the floor, strapped down, with his head in the box, letting the chloroform do its work. He expected to be in a stupor by the time that the candle burned down and dropped the axe and cut his head off. Well, I don't know if he was in a stupor, but the machine certainly worked. In fact, this poor 13-year-old chambermaid found him the next day And she started screaming. Someone else did some research on this little chambermaid. She spent the next 35 years working at that hotel, a place called the Lahr House. And she had only been there about a week when that happened. So I guess she figured nothing worse was ever going to happen. Yeah. And anyway, Moon died, obviously. And this enormous crowd of people began congregating outside the hotel to see what, and they began to move up the stairs to see this device, this machine that he had built. In fact, he even named it. He called it something like the Harikiri, supposedly because the idea of Harikiri, the Japanese idea of committing suicide. And he wrote on the long axe handle for sale or rent. So so he did keep his sense of humor. Now, after he died, his body was taken, I think it was across the street to the mortician. And I believe that what happened was Moon's family traded the device that he built inside the hotel room. They traded it with the mortician to do the coffin and the whatever else needed to be done. So, because they were not rich people, they were actually fairly poor. Moon was a very unsuccessful farmer. He spent most of his time fooling around with little devices. He tried to come up with perpetual motion, that sort of thing. Right. So, everyone liked him, but he was not very successful. So the funeral parlor got the device, and they rented a room, and they began to charge admission to see it. So and then it traveled around for apparently a couple of years, and eventually vanished. It was in the owner of the funeral parlor's attic. That was the last time it was seen. And it has since vanished, and no one, there's a rumor that it went to a museum, but no one really knows. And it was photographed. So if anyone wants to go online and look for Moon's machine, you will find a photograph that was taken of it with the photographer's assistant lying on the ground with his head in the box, the way Moon did, and the axe suspended in air. So you can see it. It was photographed, and that led, of course, to some other examples of people beheading themselves and people. The hinged axe was unusual. Most people that commit suicide that way build guillotines. In fact, it's interesting. My father is an engineer, and I asked him about that, and he said, because I had this theory that one of the reasons that men built guillotines was that they enjoyed building the thing, because some of these things were built with enormous care. And I know, for example, at least one example where the person that did it was an engineer. And my father, again, who is an engineer, said that a hinged axe might do the job, but it wasn't the sort of thing you could take pride in. I thought that was really interesting, because my father immediately began thinking, well, let's see, if you're going to build a guillotine, that raises very specific challenges. And again, he's an engineer. He starts making drawings about, so let's see, you do it this way and the other. It wasn't enough to chop your own head off. You got to do a good job doing it.
Well, sure.
And like I said, you will find examples of homemade guillotines that were built with exquisite care. It's really very interesting. The most popular form of self-beheading is and I know that sounds like a strange thing to say, but the most common form of self-beheading usually involves someone drinking too much and deciding they're going to end it all by laying their head on the train tracks then waiting. Yeah. That's the most common. Oh my God. I had to look at pictures of what the results were. It's not pretty.
No, I'm sure.
Because, you know, it's not like the train wheel just cuts it off. It mashes it.
Yeah.
But then probably the most interesting development about on the self-beheading scene in the last few years has been, this is almost exclusively done by men who are mad at their wives or girlfriends. I don't know why, but it's happened several times. And what they will do is they will tie one end of a wire or rope to a tree or a stump or a fence or a pillar of some kind, tie the other end around their neck, and then drive away.
Huh.
This yanks the head right off.
Yeah, I would think so.
And then the idea, but then, you know, think about it. Then there's this headless body driving down the road with its hands on the steering wheel and blood shooting. It must be a gruesome sight.
Man.
Anyway, I think they do it mainly to make their wives and girlfriends feel bad.
Well, I guess that would do it. Before we run out of time, I wanted you to talk a little bit about The Bye-Bye Man, because this has actually been turned into a movie.
Yes, yes. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe we've been talking all this time. Yeah, it was. It's probably the least typical of anything I've ever written. It was a true story, happened to a friend of mine, and it involved him and his then-girlfriend and a mutual friend. They experimented with a Ouija board and came into contact with this being, phantom, whatever you want to call him, monster, that, according to what he was told through the Ouija board, would lock on to the minds of anyone who thought about him and then hunt him down. And the bye-bye man was blind and an albino, and he wore this outfit almost like a tramp, but with a pea coat, and he carried a bag that was stained with blood called his sack of gore, and he was accompanied by this little creature made from eyes and tongues that were stitched together called Gloomsinger, and Gloomsinger would help him hunt down the victims. What Gloomsinger would do is, when it got close enough, would let out this whistle, and the whistle would lead the bye-bye man to the new victim. At least that was the story. And two of the people involved in it had very strange experiences after they had done holding the seances that suggested maybe something like the bye-bye man might have existed. Again, I'm sorry, I didn't, we should have started talking about it sooner. I hate to give a short shrift like that, but if anyone wants to read it, they should read the book The Bye-Bye Man, which is available on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble.
How true to the story is the movie?
It not very, but that didn't surprise me. I mean, it, again, like most paranormal phenomena, it was some weird things happened, then petered out. That's what happened. And again, I knew when they were going to bring it to the screen that it needed a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, it needs a resolution.
Right, right, right.
I will say one thing that I was really liked about the movie, and I enjoyed the movie thoroughly. It got some of the worst reviews I have ever seen. It was trashed, but it made a lot of money. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a sequel. But one thing they did was they took Gloomsinger. Now, they took him and they took him in a different direction that I thought was really interesting. They made Gloomsinger into a dog, this sort of a creepy, skinless dog, which actually made a lot of sense because Gloomsinger helped the bye-bye man hunt like a dog does and let out a whistle. The way hunting dogs will let out a yelp or a bark or a howl to alert the hunter that they're onto the prey. So I really thought that was an interesting innovation. And if the bye-bye man actually does enter into American folklore, I wouldn't be surprised if it happens that way. By the way, I'd like to say one more thing about the bye-bye man.
Oh, no. We got a few minutes if you want to talk a little more about it.
Bye-bye man, I would like to say, and this did annoy me, and that was all the people that called him a Slender Man ripoff. I would like to point out that the Bye-Bye Man story happened in the 1990s. It appeared in my book in 2005. I wrote it, of course, in the years before that. And I don't think The Slender Man appeared. I don't remember the year that the creepypasta thing was done, but I think it was the earliest was 2009. So The Bye Bye Man is considerably older than The Slender Man. And although, of course, there were Slender Man elements that became incorporated into The Bye Bye Man when they made it into a movie, which didn't surprise me at all. That actually made perfect sense. Because they are both tall, thin, terrifying spirits, or maybe not spirits. No one even really knows what they are.
Right, right. Now, what kind of experiences did your friends have with it? Yeah, it was 2009 that Slender Man was created.
Okay, so again, Bye Bye Man is about 20 years, almost 20 years older than Slender Man.
Right. What kind of experience did your friend have?
There were really two. First of all, my friend had no experiences. He never does. He is fascinated by the paranormal and has been trying to have a paranormal experience for years. But he is apparently a paranormal buzzkill. Nothing ever happens around him. Even I've had weird things happen to me that I couldn't explain, but not him. Anyway, this happened to his girlfriend. The first thing was that they would begin to have nightmares and anxiety attacks and waking up during the night and all that. But what that led to was she and him. I hate telling the story this way. I'm so used to telling it from beginning to end, but the experiences involved hearing the whistling and. In the case of, so she heard the whistling, and for the other friend, he had something, possibly it was a vivid dream, but this is what happened, this is what he felt happened. Something appeared at his door in the middle of the night and spoke in the friend's voice asking to be let in and to come and to come out and join them and go to breakfast. Even though it is a very spooky story, and again, I hate to tell it that way, but it frightened them both very badly. In fact, when it came time to get releases, I had to get them to sign releases to make the film. Mm-hmm. She was fine with it. She said, you know, she didn't want any money. She said she had one thing, though. She had one demand that I'll never forget, and that is she wants nothing to do with it. It terrified her, and it still does. So whatever it was that happened, I can tell you one thing. The people involved did not do it because they wanted to make money or because they wanted publicity. Just the opposite.
So – how did this thing communicate to them and tell them so much detail?
Through the Ouija board.
So it was just like letter by letter?
Over a period of time. Again, when I go into the whole story, I can explain it. I can give you a better explanation than that. It all began with a Ouija board experiment. They were given a Ouija board and they decided to fool around with it, do some experiments, see if they could find something paranormal. That is to say, see if they could find something, a bit of information that there was no way they could discover anyway that wasn't paranormally. So they wanted to get in touch with a spirit that would tell them something that they could look up and prove or disprove the accuracy of it. And through that, they eventually reached this thing that said it was still alive. It wasn't a spirit. It was alive and wanted to contact them. In fact, there were aspects of it that never made it, that did not appear in the movie. For example, the Bye Bye Man gave them this technique for making him find them even faster, which was not appreciated. But it's there in the book.
All right. Well, maybe if you don't mind, we can do that. You can tell the whole story for patrons. What do you think?
Sure, if you like.
Okay. All right. Well, tell people where they can find your books, where they can find you online.
Sure. First of all, my books are The Bye Bye Man and Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist. And of course, those are on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble. If you enjoy the kind of stories I'm talking about, you should go to my Facebook page, which is called Historian of the Strange, and you should sign up to follow because I do post something every day. Usually it's an old story, but you never know. I post a wide variety of things. And you can also email me through, you can email me through Historian of the Strange or through my, write to me at my email address, which is Damon, D-A-M-O-N, 333 at earthlink.net.
All right. Well, I thank you. And we'll have an extra bit for patrons where you tell the whole story of the Bye-Bye Man.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that. And I'm trying to find a fitting song to end the show with, and I think I've done it. This is One Eyed Doll, and you can find them on Bandcamp or oneeyeddoll.com. I think it's oneeyeddoll.com anyway. Just search for them. You'll find them. This is a song called You're a Vampire. See you next week.
Because you're a vampire. You're a vampire.